Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the October 26th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. First, I want to thank all of you who called in and subscribed during our fall fund drive when Joy LeClaire of Forthright Radio, calling from Boulder, and I were on the air asking for your pledges to support our programs and this listener-sponsored radio station. Your support during a difficult economic period was gratifying to all of us, and we plan to continue to bring you the programming that has earned your loyal support over the years. Today is no exception. About 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Hanna Albayati, an Iraqi-French journalist based in Brussels, but at the moment in Cairo, about a recent article she co-authored concerning the response of intellectuals to the Arab Spring and the Libyan uprising, and getting her thoughts on the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Iraq. This past week, since my last program, has been witness to a number of important events about whose long-term impacts we can only speculate, but that they will have an impact is a certainty. The bloody assassination of a wounded Muammar Gaddafi, captured by Libyan rebels outside of Sirte last week, and captured in a very different sense on cell phone cameras by those who took part in the killing, marked the end of at least one unique phase of a very unique war. It was the first time in which gruesome images of wanton violence, the likes of which we never see on the nightly news, were not taken by professionals with expensive cameras, but by those engaged in the violence, the fighters themselves. And they took no pains to hide the brutality and cruelty of their actions, which they proudly made visible on computers around the world. If indeed these were the birth pangs of a new Libya, free from 42 years of dictatorship, they do not bode well for that country's future. Meanwhile, on Sunday in neighboring Tunisia, where the self-immolation of street peddler Mohamed Bouazizi last December set up what became known as the Arab Spring, the people had a chance to vote in a free and fair election for the first time. Much to the dismay of Western Washington and its Western allies, the Ennahda, a moderate Islamic party reportedly modeled after Turkey's ruling AKP, or Justice and Development Party, claimed what Reuters described as a thumping victory. While election officials were still counting ballots yesterday after Sunday's vote, several of Ennahda's biggest rivals had already conceded defeat. Party leaders sought to reassure secularists in Tunisia and elsewhere who see Islam as a threat to what Reuters described as, quote, liberal values, end quote, in the region, that they would share power and would not try to push through radical measures. It did not go unnoticed that the Tunisians were among those in the Arab world who celebrated the death of Gaddafi, since it was to that relatively small North African country that thousands of Libyans opposed to the Gaddafi regime fled at the beginning of the fighting. Another unique aspect of the war in Libya was the bombing campaign conducted by Washington and its NATO allies, joined by Qatar, home to Al Jazeera, flexing its military muscles for the first time. It is one that was likely to be repeated. Not only taking full advantage of a UN resolution authorizing a no-fly zone over Libya, but going well beyond it, ostensibly to defend the lives of Libyan civilians, NATO fighter bombers and U.S. drones, mainly from the U.S., France, and Britain, functioned as the air arm of the Libyan rebels, wreaking havoc on Colonel Gaddafi's army and destroying critical portions of that country's infrastructure, the extent of which is yet to be known, nor the number of civilian deaths that it caused. Nevertheless, the headlines in Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal reflected the atmosphere in Washington. Quote, NATO air strategy gains renewed praise, read the main headline, and beneath it, alliance action was beset by skepticism and logistical shortcomings, but many call it a template for future interventions. In the months before the Libyan war, wrote Journal reporters Julian Barnes and Adam Entis, NATO was seen as a creaking and possibly obsolete alliance that had outlived the purpose for which it was formed, to serve as a bulwark against Soviet power. After the death of dictator Muammar Gaddafi and the ultimate liberation of Libya, however, they went on, the alliance is looking markedly different. The squadrons of alliance fighter jets that helped rebels depose and finally defeat Gaddafi point to what defense experts see as a new template for future military intervention. The approach emphasizes quick planning, a small footprint, and limited duration engagements, according to U.S. officials assessing the outcome. NATO showed it could provide a ready-made coalition capable of conducting a far-reaching expeditionary operation, wrote the Journal reporters. President Barack Obama, an early champion of the approach, said Thursday that it, quote, demonstrated what collective action can achieve in the 21st century, our Nobel Peace Prize winner. Indeed, two neocon-spawned Washington think tanks that you may not have heard of, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and Foreign Policy Initiative, that can best be described for what they are, the successors to PNAC, the Project for New American Century, came out yesterday with a joint bulletin endorsing some potential measures to be taken against Syria, including, quote, a maritime operation to enforce stronger sanctions, a Kosovo-style airstrike campaign, or a military invasion to carry out regime change. The United States, it went on, should not only keep those options on the table, but also explore the following intermediate steps. Impose crippling sanctions on the Syrian government, provide assistance to Syrian opposition, and impose no-fly, no-go zones in Syria. Despite gridlock in the UN Security Council, their bulletin concluded, the United States nonetheless has options responding individually and in concert with others to the Assad regime's continuing assault on the Syrian people. After months of relentless violence, the people of Syria are now increasingly demanding decisive international action to prevent further bloodshed. It's time for policymakers and lawmakers in the United States to act. That's the Foreign Policy Initiative and Foundation for Defense of Democracy. The men writing this are not Washington lightweights. On the Foreign Policy Initiative's board can be found neocon heavies and Fox News talking heads Robert Kagan, Bill Kristol, and Dan Senor. The first two were drumbeaters for the war in Iraq, and Senor, of course, made his name serving as spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition authority in Iraq after the invasion. He is also an investment banker and a member of the Council for Foreign Relations. On the leadership team of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which emerged immediately after 9/11, one finds the same Bill Kristol, Senator Joe Lieberman, former CIA Director James Woolsey, former FBI Director Louis Freeh, Robert McFarlane, Reagan's National Security Advisor at the time of Iran-Contra, and former Ambassador Max Kampelman, the founder of JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, which has direct ties to both Israel's and America's military-industrial complexes. Bill Kristol, perhaps the most insane chicken hawk of them all, had just last week demanded that President Obama all but blow Iran off the map on the basis of what appears to be a government initiative, initiated sting, and a poorly conceived one at that. According to Attorney General Eric Holder, a plot had been directed and approved by elements of the Iranian government and specifically senior members of the Quds Force, quote, which is part of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, that is an Iranian-American used car salesman in Corpus Christi, Texas, Mansour Arbabsiar, in collusion with a second Iranian, Gholam Shakouri, who Holder alleges is a member of the Quds Force, arranging to pay $1.5 million to the Zetas, Mexico's most dangerous drug cartel, who sneak across our porous borders and assassinate the Saudi ambassador, Abdel al-Jabir, in his favorite Washington restaurant. According to the indictment, the Zetas would not only kill the ambassador, but would do so by blowing up the restaurant while he was eating there, even if it caused the death of hundreds of innocent diners and perhaps some not-so-innocent members of Congress. Federal prosecutors say Arbabsiar had, quote, confessed to his own role in the plot to kill the ambassador and provide extremely valuable intelligence, end quote. The Zeta gang member contacted by Arbabsiar just happened to be a U.S. government informant, and if the government's past is prologue, it is more than likely that he was the one who suggested carrying out the assassination in a crowded restaurant. Iranian officials, as could be expected, described the case as a fabrication and contended that the second man, Shakouri, was actually a key member of the Mujahideen al-Khalq, or MEK, an exiled opposition group which was once allied with Saddam Hussein and has support from a number of members of Congress who want to remove from the State Department's terrorist list. According to Iran's Mayor News Service, Interpol has found new evidence showing that the Shakouri is a key member of the Mujahideen Khalq and that he was last seen in Washington and Camp Ashraf, the MAK's base in Iraq. Thus far, Interpol has made no comment on the Iranian statement. Robert Dreyfus, writing in The Nation, notes that if the scheme were actually carried out and was traced back to Iran, quote, the United States would already be launching a massive aerial attack against Iran's top military installations and its nuclear research program. Killing Jabir, Dreyfus goes on, a non-royal Saudi who's little more than a go-between for King Abdullah, at the risk of provoking war between Iran and the United States, ranges from highly unlikely to out of the question for either Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei or President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. That's according to Dreyfus. And according to Washington analyst, he notes, it's wildly out of character for General Qasem Soleimani, the coolly calculating leader of the Quds Force of the Iran Revolutionary Guards Corps. End quote. Nevertheless, Bill Kristol is undeterred and won't wait for justice to take its course. Writing in the October 24th edition of the Weekly Standard, the leading neocon organ which he edits, under the headline, Speak Softly and Fight Back, Kristol declared that, quote, this Iranian regime has the blood of American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan on its hands. It's a sponsor and facilitator of terror organizations that have killed innocent Americans, Israelis, don't forget Israelis, yes, Iraqis, Afghans, Argentines, and many others. It's a brutal dictatorship and is seeking nuclear weapons while denying it's doing so. It's long since been time for the United States to speak to this regime in a language it understands, force. That's Bill Kristol. And now we have an engraved invitation to do so. The plot to kill the Saudi ambassador was a lemon. Statesmanship involves turning lemons into lemonade. So we can stop talking, writes Kristol. Instead, we could follow the rat lines in Iraq and Afghanistan back to their sources and destroy them. Lest the administration hesitate to act out of fear or lack of support at home, Congress should consider authorizing the use of force against Iranian entities that facilitate attacks on our troops, against IRGC and other regime elements that sponsor terror, and against the regime's nuclear weapons program. The next speech we need to hear from the Obama administration, wrote Kristol, should announce that, after 30 years, we have gone on the offensive against this murderous regime. And the speech after that, he concluded, can celebrate the fall of the regime and offer American help to the Democrats building a free and peaceful Iran. William Kristol, unindicted war criminal. That's my opinion. Finally, President Obama's announcement that all American troops will be withdrawn from Iraq at the end of 2011, following Iraq's refusal to grant them immunity had they stayed, has been greeted with derision by some of the very hawks who were responsible for the war in the first place. Not the least of them is Kenneth Pollack, now of the once independent, now Israeli-occupied Brookings Institution, whose book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, published in 2002 under the auspices of the Council for Foreign Relations, was considered a major factor in selling Americans on the war. With a whimper, not a bang, was the title of Pollack's critique, which was released by Brookings last Friday. After criticizing both Obama's handling of the situation as well as the actions of the Iraqi government, which in essence booted the Americans out, Pollack concludes by asking, is Iraq doomed to another round of horrific civil war? Not necessarily, he replies. Nothing is inevitable. Iraqis might recognize that they are headed for the falls and make the selfless, heroic efforts necessary to turn their ship around. But the history is pessimistic and the trends are worrisome. Nothing they have done so far suggests that they will. America's troops in Iraq, went on Pollack, disliked, misunderstood and resented, though they were Iraq's best shot at achieving a stable, pluralistic, prosperous future. Without them, writes Pollack, Iraq is not yet condemned to darkness, but its chance for redemption is dim perceptibly. End quote, Kenneth Pollack. Not a word can be found by the suffering caused by the Iraq, by the war that he championed, nor a hint of regret. Frederick Kagan, who was credited for proposing the surge in Iraq, writing in the Weekly Standard with his wife Kimberly, notes, painfully, that, quote, our efforts in Iraq end neither in victory nor defeat, success nor failure, but simply in retreat. Writing on his own in the American Enterprise Institute blog, Kagan complains that, quote, the withdrawal of American military protection from a state helpless to defend itself on its own effectively throws Iraq into the arms of Iran, however the Iraqis feel about the matter, end quote. Max Boot, who was once a guest on this program, sings the same tune. Far from being a cause for celebration, he writes, Obama's announcement that we will keep only 150 U.S. troops in Iraq after the end of the year down from nearly 50,000 today, represents a shameful failure of American foreign policy. They risk undoing all the gains that so many Americans, Iraqis, and other allies have sacrificed so much to achieve. The risk of a catastrophic failure in Iraq now rise appreciably. The Iranian Quds force must be licking its chops because we are now leaving Iraq essentially defenseless against its machinations. Whether or not their concerns about the future of Iraq turn out to be true, the neocons did not go down without a fight. In mid-September, the Foreign Policy Initiative released an open letter signed by 43 of what the FPI described as foreign policy experts and former U.S. government officials that urged President Obama to ensure that a significant U.S. military presence remains in Iraq after 2011 to assist the Iraqi government. The Iraqis apparently felt otherwise.